This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. This past flu season was especially severe, but 100 years ago, there was a far deadlier flu pandemic. 50 to 100 million people died from the 1918 flu. So what can we learn from looking back at that disease and that took place 100 years ago? Historian James Lalutis is here to tell us. He's a professor of history at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He studies the modern South and has studied the 1918 influenza epidemic. Pandemic, I should say. Welcome, Jim.
Good to be with you, Frank.
Tell us about this. I mean, 1918, what time period, what time frame did this flu pandemic occur?
Well, this pandemic unfolded really in three waves. The first wave, what epidemiologists would call the Herald outbreak, came in the spring of 1918, and it actually was relatively mild and went by mostly unnoticed. The deadliest of the three waves came in the late fall, early winter of 1918-1919, and that's the one, as you described, really circled the globe and killed somewhere around 3 to 6% of the world's entire population. And then the pandemic closed out late in 1919 with the third wave, again, relatively mild.
What made it so deadly?
It was a novel strain of influenza A, and epidemiologists still argue about where it originated. The best evidence is that it originated probably in the hospitals in France, where you had a real concentration of people living very closely with the hogs and chickens that had been brought in as a food supply in very unsanitary conditions. And, of course, that is the way that the flu virus mutates, by hopping back and forth from birds to pigs to humans. And then it spread very, very rapidly. Because it was a novel strain, there was low herd immunity in most human populations. And so the virus spread very quickly, primarily along lines of troop movement.
And what was the story here in North Carolina? What was the effect here?
Yeah. Well, the virus showed up first in North Carolina in mid-September in Wilmington. And of course, that made sense because Wilmington's ports connected it to the movement of men and material for the war effort. And then the virus spread very quickly, mostly along rail lines in North Carolina, so that by October it had made its way all the way across the state into even the sort of most remote rural hamlets in the Western Mountains.
What kind of medical infrastructure do we have to deal with it?
The answer is really not much. The state legislature had established a state board of health back in 1877, but the first county board of health was not established in 1911. So state authorities really had very little by way of a public health apparatus.
Would it have
on to try to deal with the epidemic?
And I wonder how much it would have helped, because given the nature of this particular flu virus, we're learning that we've known now that it was younger, more healthy people who were actually most affected. Some died within weeks. Would it have mattered if they got to the hospital?
It probably wouldn't have mattered much. Perhaps in terms of the ability to provide nursing care for the sick. Perhaps in terms of being able to do more by way of education, helping people understand how flu was spread and how they could sort of block the transmission. But as you say, it was a particularly deadly strain of flu. And one of the things that was unusual about it is that when we think of flu and the people who die of flu, we usually think of the very young and the old. In the case of this flu strain, it killed mostly middle-aged adults. And it killed them from an overly robust immune reaction, so that people's lungs filled with fluid from an inflammatory response, and you literally drowned to death. And in a lot of cases, death could actually come in a matter of days. There were many patients who died within 48 hours.
Now, one thing the state
spiked a fever.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. And one of the things the state, I guess, did try to do was to prevent the spread of the flu, and that was an interesting program. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, on October the 3rd, the State Board of Health sent out a bulletin that was published in newspapers statewide to try to teach people how flu was transmitted. And then 2 days later, on October the 5th, 1918, the Board of Health ordered a closing of the public schools and banned public meetings, including church services, as a way of trying to control the spread of the disease. But, you know, as you were suggesting earlier, there really was no infrastructure, particularly for addressing the needs of people who were sick with the flu. And so what state authorities did is they turned to home demonstration agents and turned them into a kind of amateur public health force. These are women who had been employed in a program that started back in the early teens with federal money. They were in most counties in the state, and they had been involved in helping farm women learn to can, developing markets for eggs and butter, teaching about sanitation, the construction of sanitary privies. And so the state called on those home demonstration agents to mobilize women in communities all across the state into a kind of ad hoc amateur nursing corps.
Wow, that's dangerous work, right?
Well, it was very dangerous work. It was very high-risk work, and so there was quite extraordinary bravery involved. In black communities, women teachers took on much the same sort of role, and in their communities organized this same sort of impromptu nursing care. And, you know, it's worth an important footnote here, too, and that is that while this virus was very deadly across the board, it hit black communities the worst. And you can understand that when you think that and understand that we're talking about a population, mostly sharecroppers and tenants, living in extreme poverty, whose health, even under the best of circumstances, was also fragile. The mortality rate among black North Carolinians was about 1.5 times higher than that for whites.
We're talking about this now and have been on the 100th anniversary, but you say it was almost forgotten at a certain point in American history, right?
Yeah, I have to say that's one of the things that really surprised me when I started doing research, because, you know, you would going into this think, well, this catastrophic event, this must have been an important turning point in the ways that people thought about policymaking and public health. What's interesting is that there's very little evidence that that happened. There were fewer hospitals in North Carolina by the end of the 1920s than there had been at the time of the epidemic. By the end of the 1920s, only 25 out of 100 counties had a department of public health with full-time employees. And I think there are probably a couple of reasons for that. One, you know, is the character of the epidemic. It struck very quickly. It inflicted great suffering, but it was over in about 8 to 12 weeks, the worst of it. And so unlike other pandemic diseases that, you know, might come to mind, HIV/AIDS in our time or the plague in medieval Europe, this strain of influenza A did not become a recurring source of death and social and economic disruption. And so what seems to have happened is that people put that pandemic almost in a category by itself, uniquely catastrophic, and for that reason, something you couldn't anticipate or plan for, even with the benefit of hindsight, of having, you know, been through a crisis like this. And we also should remember that death was a constant presence among the living in a way that we can't so easily imagine today. If you looked at diseases that we don't think a lot about in our time, tuberculosis, pellagra, diphtheria, typhoid, cholera, those diseases took the lives of well over 5,000 North Carolinians a year. Yeah. So the flu was exceptional, but it was in the context of a much higher death rate, particularly from infectious disease, than anything we're familiar with in our time.
Fascinating stuff. Jim, thank you so much for being with us.
Absolutely.
James Laloudis is a history professor at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Well, since 1918, we have developed the technology to make flu vaccines. Ralph Barrick knows about that. He's a professor of epidemiology at the UNC Gilling School of Global Public Health. Ralph Barrick, welcome to the State of Things.
Hi, Frank. Thank you for having me on.
Good to have you here. How do we decide which strain to create a vaccine for?
So that's a annual sort of circle race that occurs between the scientific community and influenza each year. It starts around September with epidemiologists and physicians and other healthcare professionals from in about 140, 150 centers around the world that collect information on influenza, influenza cases, the kinds of substrains that are causing the disease, the severity of disease, the epidemiology in terms of which ones are spreading more efficiently, and these centers collect data for about 5 or 6 months, and then all of that data goes to five sort of central centers, like the CDC here in the U.S. and the CDC equivalent in China or in Japan. And now that data then flows into the CDC. And in February, a group of specialists from these centers, as well as outside experts and people from the WHO, sit down and go through the data in a marathon session that lasts a week or two, and they identify which strain they think will be causing next year's disease in human populations.
You have to do that. Then you have to go into production, right?
Then they have to immediately decide, okay, these are the strains that will be used to manufacture the vaccine. The key surface antigens that make people immune to flu have to be put into the backbone of a attenuated strain that grows really well in eggs. At the same time, egg manufacturers are producing a large number of eggs from chickens so that they can grow this vaccine up, and that occurs in June. And then the manufacturer has to develop the batches and test them for purity and immunogenicity, and the vaccine is then released around September if everything goes right.
We do that, and I have to say, the effectiveness rate, I mean, it rarely goes above 50%. That is to say, people have gotten it and get the flu anyway kind of half the time, and that's in a good year. Am I right about that?
It ranges from about 10% in some years, like 2004 was a really bad year, and 2014 was a really bad year, to up to about 70%. But you're quoting overall statistics for the three flu strains that are included in the vaccine. So just to take a step back, there's an H1N1 strain, there's an H3N2 strain, and then there's an influenza B strain that are part of the vaccine. And so, for example, this year, the flu vaccine wasn't so effective, except for certain components worked exceptionally well.
So what does that mean? I mean, in terms of, protecting us from the flu with rates like that, I mean, are we any better off, or does the technology get better over time? Because it does seem to vary from year to year and not in one direction.
So that's a complicated question. So in terms of this year, the H1N1 component of the vaccine is 70% effective. So it works great. The H3N2 component was about 25% effective, so it's not as good. And the the flu B component, which actually consists of two different strains, one strain works great, the other strain is not so great, and so it's about 42% effective. So then you have to think about what those numbers mean, and what the numbers actually mean is the rate of infection in individuals. It doesn't really talk about the severity of disease. So a vaccine can protect in a couple of different ways. It can completely prevent infection, or it can reduce infection significantly so that you don't have severe disease, or it can fail completely, in which case you will experience the full-born pathogenic effects of the virus. So even in a year where the vaccine is not completely effective, it could be reducing virus titer by 1 to 2 logs or 100-fold, and that's the difference between ending up in a hospital on critical care versus being home and not feeling so well.
Now, you described that process for deciding, you know, sort of making the guess about which virus is going to be or viruses we should focus on. If there were a severe flu outbreak today, how long would it take, do you think, to create an emergency vaccine?
Well, we actually had that occur in 2009 with the emergence of the H1N1 2009 pandemic strain. It was derived from swine influenza strains that heralded back to the 1918 influenza virus. So when that virus emerged, it also went into swine. And that virus doesn't evolve very quickly in swine. And so it returned in 2009. And we had a very short window to create a vaccine. Fortunately, there were enough eggs to produce that vaccine. But the problem was that because of the short timeline, it didn't grow as well in eggs as the manufacturers had hoped. And so the vaccine was in short supply, especially in the months of September and October. However, people got vaccinated. So there's a lot of variables that can affect how quickly that vaccine can make it to market. Most of them are centered around how efficiently the virus replicates in the eggs that are used to manufacture the vaccine.
We heard Jim Laloutis tell us just a minute ago that one of the factors that accounted for the spread and virulence of the 1918 epidemic was a kind of a low herd immunity. It was a particular strain that hadn't been seen for quite a while, and as a result, there wasn't much immunity among humans. How are we now? I mean, have we seen enough variety in these strains to be okay? And do the vaccinations help us on that score, or is there a big one waiting for us?
So that's a two-part question. I'll answer the first part. So in the last 150 years to 200 years, there have been three what are called hemagglutinin genes, and these are sort of like the lollipop projections that stick out of the virus that determine what strain of influenza is. And those three hemagglutinin genes have been circulating in human populations called H1, H2, and H3. So H1 caused the 1918 and the 2009 outbreaks, pandemics. H2 caused the Asian pandemic in 1957, and H3 caused the Hong Kong outbreak in 1968. Now, since 1968, there have been two hemagglutinin types circulating in human populations. That's H1 and H3. We haven't seen H2 hemagglutinin strains since 1968. So anyone under the age of 50 basically has never seen that flu strain. So the population on Earth that has immunity to H2 is becoming progressively less with each passing year.
Now, is that something that we can manage and sort of do an H2 vaccine, you know, booster for everybody, and just because we know it's hanging out there waiting for us?
Well, yes. So there are experimental H2 and H2 type vaccines that are available. The question is which H2 strain subtype will cause the disease. So you may end up with a mismatch like what occurs oftentimes with the classic flu vaccine that we receive, and it may not give 100% immunity. So you may see partial protection.
Is there a concern? Go ahead. Finish your thought.
So that's an issue. But again, if there is a early wave of disease that occurs in the spring, then we have time to match the vaccine perfectly. So it just depends on timing. If it appears in September, October, and catches us completely off guard, then you know, the chickens haven't started laying the eggs. So there's delays in terms of the process of actually making that vaccine.
So the chickens may not have come home to roost, but the virus has, and that's bad timing.
That's right.
Okay, Ralph Barrick, thank you so much. Professor of Epidemiology at UNC Gilling School of Global Health, thanks so much.
All right, you take care.
I was talking also earlier with James Laloutis, and they will both be speaking at the symposium Going Viral, Impact and Implications of the 1918 Influenza Pandemic. That's at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. The symposium starts tonight. It runs through Friday, April 6th, so bring your coffee. It's going to be a long, long event. You can find out more about that event at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, many fell in love with her story of travel, love, and second chances in her memoir, Under the Tuscan Sun. Frances Mays is back with her new book and even more hope. She's with us in a moment. Stay tuned.